Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is United States and German Relations, and today's guest is German Ambassador to the United States, Peter Amon. Peter Amon, who has been the United States Ambassador since 2011, he holds a doctorate in economics from Berlin's Free University, most recently serving as State Secretary at the Foreign Office. He was born in 1952 in Frankfurt. He has close ties to the U.S. through family relations and many long-standing friendships. From 1999 to 2001, he served at the German Embassy in Washington, D.C. as Economic Minister. In 2007 and 2008, he was appointed German ambassador to Paris, France. Prior to that, he served as a career diplomat in London, Dakar, Senegal, and New Delhi. From 1996 to 1999, he was the head of policy planning and speechwriter to the German president. A staunch advocate of free trade, he takes personal interest in what it takes to build a fair, peaceful, and prosperous global order. As director for General Economics at the German Foreign Office from 2001 to 2007, he helped prepare the G8 World Economic Summits for German Chancellors Schroeder and Merkel. Peter Amon is married to Marlies Heyman Amon. They have two grown daughters, Ariane and Christina. His personal interests include regular fitness workouts, hiking in nature's beauty, and listening to music and the poetry of Bob Dylan. Please join with me in welcoming our guest, Ambassador Peter Amon.
Thank you very much, Joseph, and good morning to you. And when I see all these young faces, I think nobody here knows who Bob Dylan is. I wear a tie which has drawn some looks yesterday when I was at Brigham Young University, and I see so many friendly faces here this morning, so I'm glad I brought only one tie. I've been in the diplomatic service for more than 30 years now. And I think that when you look at the world scene today, there are so many bad news or looming threats around that when I look back on these 30 years, well, I've seen the end of a Cold War, and I've seen the Berlin Wall come down, I see Germany reunite, but that's more than 20 years ago now. And in the last 20 years at least, I've never seen such accumulation of bad news. I don't want to depress you, but I just give you some hints. The nuclear threat emanating from Iran, the looming conflict in the South China Sea, the Arab Spring turning into probably something like an Arab winter, civil war in Syria. More closer to home, we have headlines speaking of low growth and the consequence, high unemployment. We have a debt crisis in Europe and in America and probably also in Japan. We have a fiscal cliff looming, and we see loss of trust in government institutions almost everywhere in the Western world. So something very profound seems to be going on, and maybe one could think that this is, again, a point in time where we witness a generational change. If you look, a generation are 20, 25 years. And if you look back 25 years, you see the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was a game-changing event. And another 25 years back, you are in 1968, you had a cultural revolution in China at the time, and you had, your parents will tell you, a deep, profound change in Western societies. Before, go further back 25 years, you come to the end of a Cold War, of a Second World War, And so every 25 years there seems to be something happening, and we are again in this in such a phase, probably. The euro crisis, again, is something I should have mentioned, but I will go say a few words about this later. Global warming, again, I should not miss this. I think my message to you today is that you will, and we can discuss this, are four theses. My first thesis, what I want you to firmly believe, is that the euro will survive and we will solve the debt crisis in Europe. The second thesis is that we, the West, Europe, America, are now a minority in the world, 7 billion people. Together we are less than 1 billion. And there are 2 billion people in the world that have never used electricity so far. And we have had 500 million people, half a billion, coming out of poverty, and they became a new force in the world, mainly China. So the world is changing a lot, and my consequence is that we, the West, must forge a continuing and even stronger alliance in the future, we who share the same values. And this is my third thesis. Our values, which are tolerance, democracy, liberty, they are always under threat from extremists from both sides, from all sides. And we must preserve them and stand for them. So I hope that America will continue to engage in the world, as Europe must do as well. And my fourth and last thesis is we must try to build trust in our institutions. What I see in Europe and in America is that as the game of politics is evolving, maybe it has something to do with the advent of social media and the way people communicate and have maintain friendships. So the advent of Twitter and Facebook and all this is changing not only the politics in the Arab world. You know what role Facebook played when the Arab Spring came about, but it also playing a role here. And what's important is that the institutions that built our democracy enjoy trust. So these are my four theses. Maybe you want to comment on them or contradict me, but I'm looking forward to our discussion. Let me say a word on the euro crisis, because I started by saying that you can be confident that we will solve this. The euro crisis is one aspect of a larger crisis. It's a debt crisis, which again affected both Europe and America. It is a result of a decade where money was cheap and high savings mainly in the Asian world and in some of the Gulf states made capital available at low rates. The consequence was first an asset price bubble. Here in America it was a housing bubble, a real estate bubble. And when this bubble collapsed, a banking crisis entailed. So now the banking crisis is now 3 years back. We had another effect from this period of cheap capital, that was that governments tended to borrow too much to please their voters. You can see this in Europe easily and in many places. Now, just to give you some figures, today the IMF says that the United States has a government deficit of 10% GDP, including local government, not only federal deficit. And the debt rate, the accumulated debt, is 100% GDP. Similar figures in Europe, 8% deficit, 80 to 90% total debt. So this is not sustainable, and the crisis broke out in Europe because the member states in Europe don't have a balanced budget proviso requirement like you have here in the United States. So countries in Europe, in particular in the South, lived beyond their means, and in the same time, in the same period, we had a problem in Europe because of different productivity gains. productivity in Germany, in the north, in particular of Europe, grew fast and remained low in southern Europe. So this created a tension again, which contributed to the breakout of this crisis. So the economic textbooks tell us that these sort of crises, financial crisis, debt crisis, and bubbles, which are a side effect of these crises, take a long time to heal. We have the Japanese example. Japan had such a crisis in the 1990s, and it took them over 10 years to come out of this. Deleveraging is a lengthy process, and it entails long periods of slow growth, usually. My assessment of the situation today is that the deleveraging in the private sector here in America is two-thirds through. So we still face financial headwinds for growth. The world economy is fairly sluggish. So we get disappointing figures from China. So there's no help coming from the outside. And of course, we have a policy of deficit reduction here in America and in Europe, which again creates some contraction on the economy. This is a painful but necessary process. It is politically difficult. You see maybe on TV the demonstrations which are actually taking place in countries like Greece, where people are revolting against the efforts of their governments to save. The situation in Europe can be put in a nutshell. There's a grand bargain. The northern countries, Germany in particular, are helping the countries on the rim, on the periphery, we buy them time by borrowing them money, and this of course is this bargain is a two-way street. We give them money for the time they have no access to the financial markets, and on the other hand, there's a promise from their side that we shall reform, that they shall rein in their spending and modernize their societies. In the end, I think that this crisis will have something good for Europe. It will move forward European integration. We are now we have just in the last 3 months negotiated what we call a fiscal contract, that is a regulation that limits the possibilities of countries, member states, to spend money. It's like the balanced budget proviso you have here in the United States. And on the other hand, we see a modernization process triggered in Europe that will make Europe more productive and more competitive. So I think in the end, there will be a lot of good news. I don't know if I shall speak much about the Arab Spring here. Maybe we should leave this to the Q&A session, if it's of interest to you. I think time is short, so I would conclude here. One thing we cannot do, and that is sitting on the fence. If we sit on our hands in this situation, and if America would come to the conclusion that it's better to withdraw from the world and rely on the protection it gets from the two oceans that surround America in the east and in the west, then we will move into a very dangerous period, and we should avoid this. I believe that the political processes also must be judged differently today. Political processes today run at Google speed, and all us old-fashioned politicians, diplomats, we are not used to that. Maybe you, the young generation, find this not very surprising. New social networks redefine the political process, and as I said earlier, in particular you, the young people, must engage. And let me close by saying that in all what lies ahead of us, Germany will be a true ally to America and a trustworthy partner to you in building a safe and secure future. Thank you very much.
We'll devote the remainder of our time to questions from the audience.
If you have a question, please state your name clearly into the microphone and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I would like to go first, if I may. For us, obviously, the most difficult question.
Oh, we'll see. So I know that the European Union's looking like it may draw closer together in the future. Do you see the European Central Bank getting more control over countries' budgets within the next decade or so, or is that something that nations will resist?
Mm-hmm. The actual debate foresees that the ECB, the European Central Bank, will get oversight over the banks, make sure that the banks have enough capital and liquidity. That will be, this is something which is negotiated right now. The oversight over the budgets will come to the European government, which is the Brussels institution we call the Commission. And this again is something we Germans have been pushing for, and we've put this in the in a treaty we call the Fiscal Compact, but it is a very complicated treaty. I think you wouldn't want to hear the details.
My name is John Francis in the Political Science Department, and my question for you is somewhat pessimistic. But it strikes me that Chancellor Merkel's great skill is that she never forecloses options as the debt crisis has continued to unfold, the euro crisis. And yet, it seems to me that in the current stage, a great deal is premised that southern states' governments can maintain order and can, in fact, honor the obligations that would come under the new budgetary implications of the European Commission. But if you looked at the Financial Times this morning, you might reach a different conclusion by looking at what's happening in Spain or Greece and what might soon happen in Italy. Would you comment on that?
Yeah. Well, I think one in today's time, one should look for a broad source of information. And there's a lot of good news coming out of the peripheral countries today, which is rarely mentioned. For example, the budget planning Italy has now decided foresees a surplus from the year 2014 onwards, and a primary surplus which is not including the debt payments, the interest payments, from already today. So these countries all have made an enormous effort, and of course it has caused a lot of disturbance in the country, in the countries, but the recent figures are all very positive. Even Greece has had a primary surplus in August, which is something which is quite surprising to those people who look at the pictures of the demonstrations in Greece. And Ireland is doing fine. Portugal is doing a great job. Spain, I think, also will solve its problems. We are very close to it, to the solution. And so I'm very optimistic. The worst is behind us.
Doug Bowers, a senior in political science, you've suggested that the nations of the world are in terrible, have debt. And because of that, physical problems are tremendous. What's your recommendation to the U.S. To get out of debt?
Well, I must be careful because I want to maintain my good relationship with the American government. But I think we all have more or less the same analysis. And the analysis is that we have to make countries grow, to grow, we have to do away with restraints on growth. That means make our supply side, speaking to an economist, more efficient. And of course, on the other hand, we have simply to accept that that in the long run, we all have to live. We all, everybody, not only America, everybody has to live within its means. I think it's like a family. And I don't know if you have had the experience, if your family income goes down for one reason or another, then you have very hard debates inside the family, who should save and for what you will spend the remaining money you have. It's always easier to adjust to an increasing income. but to adjust to a situation where the your income is going down. So this is very difficult. As you said, politically, this needs a lot of mastery to handle it. And I'm very confident that America will do this and Europe will do this.
I'm Koji, political science department graduate mm-hmm. student. And touching on your third and fourth thesis, second and third thesis about keeping United States and Europe should keep engaging in the war and spreading or proliferating democracy and the value of tolerance. What would be the Germans' strategy to strengthen existing international organization, especially United Nations, mm-hmm. while you are busy with bailing out your European members?
Okay. Well, it's a very good question. I think we need to renovate the existing structures. Most international structures we have in the world are dating from the time after the Second World War. The IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations were all created right after the Second World War. And the world has changed in between, so we have to adjust structures. And of course, we say that the Security Council, for example, does not reflect the distribution of power today. It reflects the distribution of power in the world in 1945. So we need reforms, but this is not something you can do overnight. You have to convince people. You need a lengthy conversational process.
Hi, my name is... Oh.
We are a member of the Security Council right now, but we maintain our quest for permanent membership. Yeah.
My name is Mary. I'm a senior political science student here. And my question is, with the civil war going on in Syria, what do you see as the United States, Germany, and NATO's role in the conflict?
Well, this is a very tragic and sad thing happening in Syria. And it is, I think there's a government which has committed a lot of crimes in place. And we believe that Assad needs to go. The problem, of course, is that in the course of the conflict, this has developed into a civil war and almost a religious war. The Alawites, a Shiite sect, is in conflict with the Sunnis and the Christians on the other side. And this sort of religious war, we know it all from our history, are very hard to bring to an end. Outside intervention is fairly difficult. It is a country that is substantial. It is not a desert country like Libya, for example. It is a fairly big country, we think that our options are very, very much limited. From the outside, we can, of course, do humanitarian work. We can put sanctions on the Syrian government. That's what we do. For example, if you are a Syrian government official, you may not have access on your money accounts in Europe or America. You cannot import certain things that you used to import. So, this sort of pressure on the economy might probably help to convince the elite of this country that we have to get rid of Assad. But I don't see an option which would, a military option, because that would mean an engagement that nobody really wants to do.
Hi, I'm Dylan Laird. I'm a communication and political science major here. I was wondering what the German people feel about the financial problems in Europe, and if they want to break away and go back to their own type of currency.
Yeah, they certainly will not do. The German government will not do that, and it is something I get asked in America very often, because some people say, "Look, is it useful to have a common currency in Europe? Is this from an economic or monetary standpoint?" One could say, it's not a perfect monetary union, because you have countries that are very well, growing fast and have a high-tech industry basis, and others that are more agricultural based and growing slowly. So this might not be an ideal currency unit, I agree to that point, but we have this union for political reasons. And you must understand the history of Europe, starting from the Second World War and all what followed, why we stick to that, even if it's if it comes at a price.
My name is Brad Atkin. I'm a political science major. Mm-hmm. In my European politics class, we've been talking about countries becoming a part of the EU, and we've been talking specifically about Turkey and the possibility of it becoming a member of the EU. What do you think the likelihood is of Turkey, especially being a non-Christian country, becoming mm-hmm. a member of the EU, and what do you think its effects would be on Germany, both culturally and economically, if that were to happen?
Yeah. Well, we have... how many Turks in Germany? I think we have at least 3 million, if not 4 million, Turkish citizens living in Germany. So we know the Turks, and they know us, and they like it in Germany. Otherwise, we wouldn't be there. So this is not a problem, and religion also is not a problem because we don't define the United Europe as a Christian institution. The fact that Turkey is a mainly Islamic country, Muslim country, would not be something that would be such a problem. We have offered Turkey membership already in the 1960s, but said that this comes under a certain condition. And these conditions have to do with the way Turkey sets its internal rules. For example, we have defined certain economic regulations that the Turkish government must fulfill. We also insist on full democracy. You may remember that for a long time Turkey was run by the military. I think we could put pressure on those countries who want to join that we must adapt to our standards of democracy and freedom. And what we've seen in Turkey over the last years was a strong democratization movement. Turkey is much more liberal today than it was earlier. It is a democratic country, and it has seen economic growth, and it has become a big exporter in the region. So there are a lot of good developments. What the people will decide in the end, and I think it will have to go through the hands of the vote in Turkey, then this is up for grabs. But the trend has shown a lot of convergence.
Hi, I'm Dylan, a second-year student here, International Studies. And my question to you is, the U.S. is still involved pretty heavily in the Middle East, and we add on to our debt every day, most of which belongs to China. So having spoken with other people, other economists and diplomats, how do you feel about China continuing to lend us money? And will they put their foot down and ask to recollect anytime soon?
Well, the fact that China lent you money or bought American treasury bonds, is a direct result from a high savings rate. The Chinese people are big savers. Savings rates went almost 40 up to 50% of their income was saved. And what do you do with savings? You can invest them in your own country. And they have done so heavily. China has seen an investment boom over the last decades. But there was even some money left. And this money went to America. They bought treasury bonds mainly for it. So the question is, will the high savings rate in China persist? And some people say, as societies become richer and more mature, these savings rates go down. Savings rates in America are very low. They used to be even negative a few years back. I think now they are now in positive territory. And savings rate in Germany is around 14%. So This is not. This is about the money we need to invest, and we invested in Europe. Why are the Chinese saving so much, or why were they saving so much? And this had to do with insufficient structures in these pensions. Someone in China had to save for his or her pension. So in Europe and America, you expect Social Security to kick in once you are 65. So you don't have such an incentive to save. And this, as these structures adapt and become more like our structures, some people predict that the savings rates will go down. And then the question is, will there be enough money to buy your treasury bonds here? Again, an open question.
Hi, my name's Brad Call. I'm an international studies student here at the U. My question touches on the Arab Spring. I'm curious what the German opinion on the events in Egypt and the other areas in North Africa, what the German opinion is on that, and also are there any plans for action in other areas of North Africa? For example, Mali is in a serious crisis. Can you address those conflicts at all?
I remember in February last year, almost all the actors in international diplomacy were united at the Munich Security Conference. And I remember we had very hot debates there how to react on this phenomenon that nobody had expected. The Arab Spring came as a surprise to everybody, as the fall of the Berlin Wall came as a surprise to everybody. And in the end, the debate boiled down to the question, shall we in future support dictators that provide us with stability and cheap oil, maybe, in some countries, or shall we opt for the risk of supporting those demonstrators that are asking for free elections? And of course, when you support them, when you opt for democracy, so to speak, then you run huge risks, because it might happen that people get elected in these elections that will abolish democracy then afterwards. So this was a very difficult debate, and I'm very happy that in the end Americans and Europeans all agreed that we cannot deny our principles. We must stick to our values, even if this means we have to run risks. And so we supported the democratic trend in Egypt and other countries. Mubarak went out, and we have had elections in Egypt, and we have now the Muslim Brotherhood in power, and of course this is something that raises concern with some people. But I think in the end we now are in a situation where we must talk to the Muslim Brotherhood and tell them, look, we are playing a serious game with you. We are serious about democracy and liberty, and we should not try to say we'll buy you. This would be a terrible insult to these people. We should try to stretch out our hand and say, look, we are serious about democracy, and we expect you to be serious too.
Could you speak a little bit about environmental policies in Germany and in Europe, and if and to what extent they figure into Germany-US relations?
Yeah. Well, we have a strong concern in our country about environmental issues. So we have an ecological party that is fairly powerful and was already in government and maybe will be in government again. So environmental issues are a very important issue in our political debate. And we have seen already a number of results of this. For example, I think we now have about 20% of our electricity coming from renewable energy. which is almost a world record, I think, for a big industrialized country. Germany is, as I love to say, is a cloudy, rainy country, but more than half of all solar panels in the world are installed in Germany. So it shows that we invested heavily in alternative energies, and we are closing down our nuclear reactors because we think that nuclear policy has no future. Of course, we have debated with our American friends global warming, and America has not joined the Kyoto Protocol, something which we deplored. Kyoto is now coming to the end of its lifetime, and there must be something new. The problem is that we have to address also, bring in these new economic powers like China, like India, into this debate, because now I think China is emitting more carbon dioxide than America does. At least they are approaching that level. So we have to somehow come to a solution that will bring in emissions globally. And there is a lot of work to do for diplomatic talks, but we cannot do it among us alone. It cannot be. It's not a matter between Germany or Europe and America on the other side. It's a global issue.
Hi, my name is Cody. I'm a senior in political science, and my question goes back to the euro crisis. You mentioned central countries, particularly Germany, loaning money to a lot of the outer rim countries, and I know that this has caused a lot of unrest within Germany itself, particularly along party affiliations, as some people have been enraged, to put it bluntly, against the Conservative Party's stance on loaning money to these other outer rim countries. Can you comment really quickly on what Chancellor Merkel's and her administration's policy is, or how she intends to reunite the German people, or where do you find the balance?
Well, I think we are at the point where we have seen the worst. You're right when you say that the German people is a bit flabbergasted by the sums involved. Just to give you the order of magnitude. The German guarantees to the peripheral countries in Europe amount to a quarter of $1 trillion. And just imagine, America's economy is about four times the German economy. So if you multiply this with four, imagine America setting up a fund with $1 trillion to save another country. This is, I think, would not go down well in Congress today. $1 trillion is a lot of money. It's a million millions, if some of you are not familiar with these figures. I think it is a generous move. And it has, of course, created some resentment by some who said, well, why shall we pay for others? But there's, on the other hand, a very strong feeling that we have a once-in-a-lifetime chance to unite Europe and go forward. And we have also an obligation, because the alternative, a divided Europe, is a terrible nightmare from history. Our kids learn in at school that in European history, Germany was always too small to dominate the rest of Europe, but it was too big to be an equal partner with the others. So it's about 82 million people, and France, Britain are about 60 million. So it is a strange size. We don't fit in easily in Europe, and we have now achieved a European Union, and we want to preserve that.
Sorry. I'm Zach Zabau. I'm an international studies student. And I was just wondering, on the same note, Germany has benefited heavily from being an EU member with trading with the southern countries, like you're running a surplus, if I'm not mistaken, in trade the past couple of years. And how does cutting public spending so heavily, like closing down half the schools in Greece when they're such a trading partner with you and you want them to benefit, but like when it's really a tax problem, a tax collection problem, that how does that address that?
Yeah. Well, again, it's worth looking at the figures. I think our exports to Greece are about 0.3% of our exports. This is almost nothing. And again, some effect which is not so well known even in Germany is that 90% of our export growth in the last 10 years was outside the European Union. So we are a big exporter to China. We probably have a balanced trade with China. I think we are the only industrialized country to have a balanced trade with China. We are selling a lot of to America. It's the other big market. And the European market has been flat for us for the last 10 years. So one should also not forget. Some people say we should not have a trade or a balance of payment surplus of $200 billion a year. We have a higher surplus than China. So we should not have this nationally, and we should cut down our export machine, which is running very well. I can answer to those people that if you take Europe as a whole, it has a balanced balance of payment. So it is exporting goods and services as much as it is importing. But this is because Germany exports so much to China and the rest of the world. If we would not create this surplus for Europe, then Europe as such would be deep in the red, yeah, like America is in the red. About the same order of magnitude.
My name is Nathan White, political science major. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to ask you about the formation of the European Union. In your opinion, what was the main motivation, whether it be to avoid conflict between countries in the European area, or would it be the increased possibility of competing economically with the United States? Mm-hmm.
No, I think the answer is quite clear. It's for historic reasons. And one should go back in to the early 1950s or late 1940s when the European idea emerged. People were almost desperate. It's my father's generation that went to war, and these wars were different from the wars you know in your lifetime. I think we had in the Second World War cost the life of 50 million people, 50 million. The Russians lost 20 million in this war. So these are not wars like, let's say you all know the Iraq war, Afghanistan war, you have 2,000 people lost in, which is terrible, but it is, imagine the scale of the slaughter that took place in the Second World War. And so people were absolutely desperate. They said, we must do something that will prevent any more conflict in Europe. And the idea of the founders of the European Union was that those industries that are essential for warfare, the production of iron and steel, energy, should be centralized. They should be taken away from the authority of national governments. And so before the European was created, we created a union of iron and steel. And this later developed into a European Union, which is now, I think some of you must have traveled there. It's almost like living in a big country, like living in America, where you cross state lines without showing passports, or you have the same currency, and it's almost one big country. So this is an enormous achievement of the last two generations, and we will certainly not give it up.
Michael Tischmack, I'm in history and German language. Yeah. You say that financially the worst is behind us. Would this also be true for forces calling for more European separation, or will they get louder before they quiet down?
Of course, there are some centrifugal forces in Europe, in some parties in Europe, and one should not neglect them. They address issues like too many foreigners, too much money spent for other people. That's the kind of battle cry you hear. So we will have to address this, and the idea is to reform Europe. Europe has evolved over time, and it will evolve further. It will have to evolve further. We will need more reforms, and we are working on that. So those people who say, well, this is a very lengthy and boring process, I can only say, how long did it take to build the United States? In 1776, you started, and you had 100 years, almost 100 years later, you had a civil war. So this is a lengthy, difficult story. So give us some time, but we will move forward.
Hi, Karen Baumgartner, professor of German. I want to shift the discussion a little bit to cultural issues, and I would like you to comment on the circumcision debate in Germany. It has been watched very closely here in America. It was featured in the New York Times twice, and I think here people perceive it as a freedom of religion issue, whereas in Germany it is perceived as a child welfare issue. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the government's approach to this? It's a lower court non-binding mm-hmm. decision. Mm-hmm. And what the government of Chancellor Merkel is doing to sort of control the fallout of from mm-hmm. this decision.
Yeah. Well, I found that many Americans found it difficult to understand the consequences of this lower court's decision, because you have case law. And if a court had decided in America on such a case, then this would be a binding ruling for others. It is not in Germany. So the case in Cologne, it was a lower court in Cologne who that made this decision, is only specific to the case, and. This case, I think I will spare you the details, but it obviously there was some medical botched up, some medical problem involved, and I think it's not worth to go into these details. But we were a bit shocked by the reaction of the world and in America. Although I know that even in San Francisco there was once a court ruling in a similar case. We want to make sure that Jews have a possibility to live their ways, their culture, their lives in Germany. We are happy that we have now flourishing Jewish communities in Germany, and we want to accommodate them in the best manner possible. And so we have now in the Bundestag a project of a law that will simply regulate this and say every circumcision performed according to medical and or traditional standards is permitted. So we will solve this by a law.
I'd like to go back to the energy environmental mm-hmm. question. I note that the Japanese are now having second thoughts about getting rid of nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't think the French are going to give it up anytime soon, and they're your neighbor, of course. So what is the future for German energy? Because if you stick with renewables, maybe you get up to 25%, but it still makes you very dependent on gas from Russian pipelines. Mm. Is there a kind of longer term plan to come up with energy autonomy or anything of that order?
Well, autonomy is not something I think we would strive for, but we want security of supply. And our dependency on Russian gas is going down. The gas prices are falling mainly because the gas prices in America have gone down with the advent of shale gas. So
we are not worried about this, and we will not build now a huge park of gas-fired power stations. This is not the answer to the problem. The answer to the problem is renewables. And as I said, we have these already 20% production from renewables. In, it came up from 10% about 5 years, roughly, ago. So it's growing fast. It will. There are long-term plans of 80% renewables till 2050. And till 2020, we want to have about 40% of our electricity coming from renewables. Of course, the bad thing with renewables is that wind blows at times and then it stops, or the sun shines and then it shines not. So and also demand is flexible. So we had the situation already last year on during the holiday season, and a warm, sunny day with lots of wind, electricity prices became negative. So if somebody burned some electricity, you would get money for it.
And that would be the conclusion of of today's question and answer. Please join with me in thanking Ambassador Amon for an excellent and informative report.